Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today today is World AIDS Day, and we'll begin in a moment to talk with Dr. Helene Gale, who is the Director of HIV/AIDS and Tuberculosis at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And of course, the Gates Foundation are pouring enormous sums of money into the continent of Africa, and which is, of course, where AIDS is most rampant. And we'll also talk with Francis Kissling, who is the president of Catholics for a Free Choice. And her organization, among others, is unhappy with the influence of both the Catholic Church and Christian fundamentalists in the United States in terms of preventing the dissemination of prophylactics, which seem to be the only barrier to stop the spread of AIDS. So we'll be talking about that with Francis Kissling. And then we'll change subject and talk with Stephen Schwartz, who is the author of Two Faces of Islam, The House of Saud from Tradition to Terror. We'll do a follow-up on the recent leaks and revelations that the Saudi Arabian princess, who's the wife of the ambassador to the United States, was giving money to one of the 9/11 terrorists who flew into the Pentagon. And we're getting a sense from him whether there is a campaign to drive a wedge between the United States and Saudi Arabia. And then we'll also talk with Ambassador James Akins, who is a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. So we'll be talking to him to get perhaps a different point of view in terms of what is going on between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia as the United States heads towards a war with Iraq, the deadline for which is coming up on December the 8th. I'm speaking with Dr. Helene Gale, who is the Director of HIV/AIDS and TB at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And I mentioned in the opening, Dr. Gale, that the Gates Foundation are pouring quite a substantial amount of money into Africa. Do you have any figures on how much? I know that they're also trying to they're investing heavily in a shot to prevent or to immunize people against malaria. But just in terms of AIDS,
yeah, the Gates Foundation has committed in the range of $600 million for HIV activities. Now, this goes from money for research and development for things like an HIV vaccine or microbicides, products that women could use to decrease their risk of HIV, as well as programs more directed at prevention interventions on the ground. And it's worldwide. We have considerable commitment in Africa, but have also most recently announced a large grant for India as well because of the growing epidemic there. So the focus is equally divided between finding new tools and technologies that can help to reduce the spread of HIV and then working with people in countries on specific programs that could also further the goal of reducing the spread of HIV.
And in Africa, I believe in Botswana, it's something like 1 in 3 people are infected. In South Africa, it's, what, close to 1 in 7 or 1 in 8?
Yeah, and the figures vary somewhat depending on the different geographic locations, but Botswana is currently the country that has the highest rates of HIV infection among sexually active adults, and South Africa is the country that has the highest number, even though the rates aren't as high, but because of the size of the population, the South Africa actually has the highest number of HIV-infected people, with India coming after South Africa.
And it's just been, the UN released a study this week that indicates that the feminization of AIDS, that now it's about 40 million people infected worldwide, 20 million of whom are women. In Africa, 58% of Africans infected with AIDS are women.
Right. Yes, UNAIDS released its most recent figures with the total of now 42 million people living with HIV/AIDS. And this is the first time where equal number of women as men. But this is a pattern that you see for sexually transmitted diseases. Women are at greater risk biologically, but they are also at greater risk socially because women oftentimes are not in the position to have control over the dynamics of sexual relationships. Oftentimes, in many of the surveys that have been done, it shows that women, in fact, only have one partner, but it's because of the risk of her male partner, who may have multiple partners or other risk, that puts her at risk for HIV. And so we're now seeing, as this epidemic evolves globally, that this is following the pattern of other sexually transmitted diseases where women, in fact, are at greater risk.
And what about the women passing it on to children?
Well, women, a woman who is pregnant and has HIV has about a 25% chance of passing HIV infection onto her child. There are now very good ways of reducing that risk by 50 to 75% if a woman finds out early enough that she is HIV infected and uses antiretroviral therapies. The one most currently used in developing countries is nevirapine. It's a drug that women can take in pregnancy that will cut the chances of passing the infection on to her child by 50%.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, that I'm speaking with Dr. Helene Gale, who is the director of HIV/AIDS and TB at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And this is World AIDS Day, and we're talking about the new demographics of AIDS that was released this week by the United Nations, indicating the feminization of AIDS, where now equal numbers of women and men are infected. And, of course, women are far more vulnerable to spread the disease, as Dr. Gale has just pointed out. Now, there was some resistance to reality, if you will, from Thabo Mbeki, the president of South Africa, and I don't know how much it affected the South Africa becoming behind the curve, as it were. I know they've played catch-up now, but I believe the same resistance now to some extent exists in India and in China, and of course the area of the world where AIDS is most, the fastest growing epidemic is occurring, is in Russia, Eastern Europe and Central Asia. So let's just go through that notion of denial causing so much grief down, because obviously the quicker you get to the problem and deal with it, the more chance you have of curtailing the epidemic.
No, I think your points are well taken. We know that throughout the history of this epidemic, denial is the first phase of the national response. However, I think that there are countries that now have a history to build on. It's clear that nowhere in the world has an HIV epidemic just disappeared on its own. It's always with an aggressive response that includes an enlightened, high-level political commitment that has always been important for really mobilizing the kind of resources and the commitment necessary. And so I think while it's still, denial still seems to be the hallmark of the first stage of dealing with this epidemic, we're seeing that period decrease as more and more countries come to accept at a faster rate that this is not a problem that will just go away. And so we're hoping that as there are more models of success, as there's more evidence about what can be done to make a difference in this epidemic, that that phase of denial will increasingly become a shorter and shorter period of the initial response to this epidemic, because we know that ultimately you either pay now or you pay later. The sooner you begin, the sooner you mount an aggressive response, the shorter the period of increase. And there are countries like Thailand, like Senegal, for instance, that were able to early on, before rates went very high, mount the kind of response that headed the epidemic in the other direction. So we know it's possible, but that acknowledgement is so critical.
And in terms of the spread in Eurasia and Russia and Central Asia, I believe that a lot of it is attributed to heroin use. And of course, we know that where the heroin comes from, at least where the opium comes from, is Afghanistan. So is there, I mean, in terms of prophylactics, is there any way to either, I mean, obviously we're having trouble curtailing the growth and distribution of opium, but what about needle exchanges?
I think just like when sexual transmission is the primary mode, the sooner a society accepts that drug use is a critical issue within their society and looks at a diverse response to the drug abuse and drug use epidemic that's going on. And so the best thing to do is clearly to provide the kind of treatment that will allow people who are using drugs to get off of drugs. However, we also know that for a variety of reasons, some people aren't always at that stage where they're ready to get off of drugs. And so being able to supply, take care of the public health imperative of making sure people don't reuse needles for injection is part of that response. And so just like we know that for sexual transmission, abstinence is the only 100% safe, being faithful is if both of the partners are mutually monogamous is the next best, and then using condoms or other ways of protecting oneself when those two options aren't available, that same sort of cascade of what's the most 100% safe for people who inject drugs, what's the next, you know, which is to not use drugs. Given that that's not going to be everybody's reality, what are some of the interventions that have proven to be useful, et cetera? So I think in all of this, the bottom line is there is no one-size-fits-all strategy, and from a public health standpoint, it's important to make sure that the options are available for people where they are today to keep them from getting what is a life-threatening infection.
But when you say, Dr. Helene Gale, that condoms and other means of preventing the spread of the infection, is there? I thought that condoms were it.
Well, there are male condoms. There are also female condoms. People are now looking at developing chemical products that women could use that will reduce their risk, and looking at other things like perhaps the diaphragm that's been around for a long time. Would that be a way of also providing a barrier? So I think while male condoms are what we know the most about and are the most readily available, female condoms also provide protection. And as research continues to evolve the number of options, we all hope that there will be more options, particularly for women, to keep themselves from being exposed to HIV or decrease their risk of acquiring the infection.
Just in closing, Dr. Lynn Gale, it seems like one of the other problems, apart from denial, as you mentioned, having delayed the inevitable and caused infinitely more grief and death than it should have had people acted earlier, denial is also caught up with disinformation, superstition, conspiracy theories. The commonest one of all is that AIDS was a CIA or a KGB biological weapons program that got out of hand. There are all kinds of other canards, like, you know, Jewish doctors, that anti-Semitic canard, that they were behind it all to somehow kill off the African race, and
right.
It just goes on. But I'm pretty familiar with the germ warfare program of the former Soviet Union, and I know the man who ran it, Ken Allebeck, Dr. Allebeck, quite well. I guess the problem that people have with AIDS is that nature has just thrown such an absolutely virulent, intelligent virus it's a retrovirus, so it makes RNA instead of DNA. Is that what it really is? This is just a super virus that it's going to take. Is it going to eventually run its own course?
Well, I think it's hard to tell, what the evolution of this virus is thus far. What it continues to do is mutate and change forms and diversify. and develop a variety of different genetic structures. But I think on one hand, while this is a very biologically challenging virus, I think that there are a lot of things that are patterns that we have seen before, so that it's hard. I think it puts in perspective and takes away this tendency to jump to this being so extraordinary that this has to be something that was created in a different way. It's a virus that like many viruses, were first part of the animal kingdom, that can jump species just like many other viruses that we know that jump species with close contact with different species over time. Much of the biology is known, and I think the fact that it is such a smart virus makes it clear that this is not something that a human could have figured out exactly how to make this grow, diversify, mutate over time. This is the kind of thing that happens in nature. So I think there's very clear evidence. Every time there's been a theory that seems even vaguely plausible, it's been debunked. And so I think what we all need to do is to focus on the reality. HIV is here. It is a global catastrophe. There is much that can be done about it today to stop the spread and to provide care and treatment for those already infected, and that we do need increasing technologic options like vaccines, like microbicides, and other ways that may be useful in halting the spread, getting better treatments, and that we don't need to wait until all of those answers are solved, but we need to do what we can today to make a difference. And there's a huge difference that we could make. We could save tens of millions of lives if we as a world community commit to the kind of resources and the kind of strategies that we know could make a difference today.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Helene Gale.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Dr. Helene Gale, who is the director of the HIV, AIDS, and TB project at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And I'm now speaking with Francis Kissling, who's the president of Catholics for a Free Choice. And as Dr. Gale just pointed out, Francis Kissling, that really at this point, condoms are the best, if not the only, effective barrier to spreading AIDS. Why are so many powerful institutions like the Catholic Church and the Christian fundamentalists in this country are so opposed to this means of stopping this global catastrophe?
Well, for Catholic leadership, the Vatican, the Pope, and various cardinals and bishops, the problem is the continuing objection to any form of contraception for women. And there is this enormous fear that if they acknowledge that condoms as a way of preventing the spread of AIDS is a morally legitimate act, the use of condoms is a morally legitimate act in this circumstance, it will only be one step to approving contraception to prevent pregnancy. And that's an overwhelming barrier at this point to any logical position on condoms for AIDS. And I also think, and I don't think this is only the problem of the Catholic Church, I think it's a problem of many people in the world. I think that there continues to be a lack of recognition of sexuality as a normal, healthy part of life, not only within lifelong monogamous heterosexual marriages, but...
Quarter-inch tape on the thing.
I'm sorry?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, the talk button doesn't work here. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, that's all right. This lack of recognition of sexuality as a healthy thing is, it also very much affects the religious view of the use of condoms.
Well, I mean, if a woman has HIV and she's pregnant, what would the priest say? Or she wants to have another child. I mean...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't understand that you know, how you morally choose between the inevitability of causing death and
right.
the need to have unlimited procreation.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think it is. It's mind-boggling. I mean, and we understand that the Catholic Church claims that 25% of the people currently infected are with HIV or AIDS are treated by the Catholic Church. How can you treat 10 million people with families, wives, husbands, children, etc., and maintain this kind of ban in the face of actually seeing people die as a result of such policies? There is no rational explanation for this insanity in the Catholic Church.
And what do you understand is the Christian Rite's objection? Is it the same?
It's very much the same. Well, the Christian Rite has never objected to the use of contraception within heterosexual marriage, but the Christian Rite objects enormously to homosexuality, and so much of their political propaganda and organizing of people has been based upon fear of homosexuals and castigating homosexuals, and they have a very high stake, I think, in keeping the AIDS pandemic defined as a homosexual problem. So I think that, again, we're dealing very much with politics.
And they're also opposed to needle exchanges.
They're opposed to, you know, again, it's this whole thing that the best thing to do is to be abstinent if you're not in a monogamous heterosexual marriage and neither of you ever had sex with anybody else before that. The best thing to do is to not use drugs. And if you choose to behave immorally, then, you know, the consequences are your problem. It's that simple. It's a very Calvinistic Protestant point of view.
Until, you know, their own
children
become infected. Yeah.
That's right.
I mean,
well, and then they want to send their children off to these Christian, you know, when their children, their teenagers misbehave, they want to send them off to these Christian treatment centers, not to take this in a terribly different direction, which the current president, George Bush, wants to support, where, you know, we see tough love in its extreme and corporal punishment and everything else.
And
a very, very mean-spirited view of life.
Well, I mean, and of course, the initial answer is abstinence before you even get into those that have fallen from grace. I mean, and abstinence makes the people who propagate that idea feel good, but
yes,
it is entirely impractical.
Well, it's not only do I think it's highly impractical, and I think that it's also something that has been picked up very much by many in the AIDS community. When I was at the Barcelona AIDS conference, there were, you know, medical doctors, non-governmental organizations, all sorts of ordinary liberal people who were, saying, as I think we heard Dr. Gale say, abstinence, if you could, you know, is the first and best option for preventing the disease. ABC, be faithful in a lifelong, in a monogamous relationship.
Which has to be mutually monogamous.
Mutually monogamous. And if you can't do those two things, then condoms. And there is this kind of, you know, we are dealing with a world that is increasingly conservative in terms of sexuality. So it's not just a practical, the notion that sexuality is good, is healthy, is something that people are entitled to find in their lives and not just in monogamous heterosexual marriages is simply down the tubes. No one wants to talk about that.
Let me just remind the audience again, if I may, I'm speaking with Frances Kissling, who is the president of Catholics for a Free Choice, and we're talking about the spread of AIDS on this today being World AIDS Day, and Just this week, the United Nations issued a report indicating the feminization of AIDS, where now about 42 million people in the world are infected, and over 20 million of them are women. So, and of course, women are biologically more apt to spread the disease and are much more vulnerable to infection. And it seems that at the same time that the United Nations puts out this report, which should fly in the face of the religious rights belief that AIDS is a homosexual disease,
The CDC, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, who are charged with preventing epidemics, and of course now they're charged with preventing the portent and possibility of a biological attack against the United States, they have removed all information concerning AIDS prevention, particularly with condoms. Now, where did that come from? Who would have ordered that?
Well, I'm relatively certain that that comes from the White House. There's no doubt in my mind that both Catholic conservative groups as well as Christian conservative groups have been saying for ages that condoms cause AIDS, not cure it. The late Cardinal O'Connor of New York was one of the more ardent exponents of that idea. The Vatican has said the same thing.
Now wait a minute. What do they mean when they say condoms cause AIDS? I don't understand.
They believe that the condoms fail a significant amount of time. 15 to 18% is usually a failure rate of 15 to 18% is usually what's cited by both the Catholic Church and the Christian right groups. And the CDC had on their website information that made clear that condoms used correctly have a failure rate of well under 5%, 1% to 3%. And this was driving the Christian conservatives crazy that this information was up on the website. Now, you know, I certainly can't prove that they went to the White House and complained, but they've certainly gone to the White House to complain about everything else, and I wouldn't doubt that this was part of their strategy. Even before the CDC removed it, because I remember having conversations with the CDC about this, when you would call the CDC, and reporters would tell me this, and ask what is the failure rate of condoms relative to the transmission of AIDS, the CDC would not answer those questions on the telephone and would refer the reporters to the website, because somewhere along the line they had been told not even to say it verbally.
Well, you know, it's pretty objectively true and fair and unbiased information that the President of the United States is a Christian conservative.
That's right. That this is the base of the Republican Party. So it's, you know, I mean, it's a logical conclusion. There's no other reason that the CDC, which is a government agency, would remove those pages from its website unless the Department of Health and Human Services had told them to do so.
And in case the American people hadn't noticed, the Republican Party controls both the House, the Senate, and the White House.
And pretty soon we'll control the Supreme Court.
And that specifically in the House, Tom DeLay, who's now majority leader, and whose proteges are both the whip and the speaker, he's an ultra-Christian conservative.
Yes.
And it's extraordinary, you know, that how totally biased the press is in the way that the canard is it's liberal, but all you ever hear about lately is this liberal San Francisco code for gay-loving, you know, ultra-liberal Nancy Pelosi.
Right.
Nobody talks about the pest exterminator who is so right-wing, you know, it's just mind-boggling. I mean, what a double standard. Anyway, I'm digressing. I shouldn't...
And it has terrible international ramifications. I mean, when we look at what has been going on in terms of foreign assistance, U.S. foreign assistance, the way in which the decline of that assistance, the way in which U.S. delegations to U.N. conferences have been pushing very, very conservative lines on questions of sexual health, such as AIDS, as well as reproductive health.
And the main, the bulk of the American people are opposed to this, but somehow their voices are not being reflected in the so-called democratic process here.
No, and very little of this gets reported as well. I mean, I don't think that people are anywhere near. I mean, when I say to people that, you know, church leaders say that condoms cause AIDS, not help prevent it, but people are shocked. They don't know that this language is being used, and that that both the U.S. government and the Vatican have teamed up within the United Nations to try to prevent health policy worldwide that would promote the use of condoms rather than tell people, you know, that the answer is abstinence.
Well, also, the
what is a woman in Africa supposed to do when her husband comes home after being separated for 6 months out on as a truck driver or working in a mine, and he wants to have sex with his wife? This is why we're talking about heterosexual, about transmission to women now. She has no power or right to say no to him or to demand that he use a condom. What are we doing in terms of the next step in terms of condoms is really empowering women in some way to be able to demand that their partners use them.
Well, I just wanted to add that in terms of the unholy alliance between the United States, the conservative government in the United States now, dominated by Christian conservatives, and the Vatican, also the axis of evil states that the United States is against, particularly Iran and not so much Saudi Arabia, but nevertheless Saudi Arabia also, the very fundamentalist versions of Islam also team up with the Vatican.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When it comes to sexuality, what you find is very little difference between what this administration chooses to call the axis of evil and the administration itself.
Well, just in closing, Frances Kissling, when you point out that many religious leaders have this sort of middle aged ideas that condoms cause AIDS. What is their answer to? I mean, they can't be in denial about the fact that the demographics indicate that Africa will be ravaged, Central Asia. There's even a study out this week from the American Enterprise Institute indicating that eventually this will have tremendous effects over the geopolitical and military power of China and India and other countries if they are decimated in the way that the statistics indicated they will. So are they in denial, or do they think that is it abstinence? I mean,
I think that what you're dealing with, both with Christian conservatism as well as with Roman Catholic social conservatism, is our systems where individuals and people really do not matter. It is not important whether people live or die. What is important is that a system of belief is reinforced, and that system is more important than people. And it may sound very cynical, but that indeed is the reality. These institutions know that people are dying. They know that AIDS is being transmitted. They know that people are going to have sex, and they really don't care sufficiently about human life.
And they're imbued with their own righteousness, because they don't.
Yes.
Obviously, it doesn't. It's not people that they know that are infected, except eventually it will be people they know.
It is people that they know. I mean, we know certainly. I mean, if you talk in the Roman Catholic community, we know that many, you know, a significant number of priests have died of AIDS. That there are significant numbers of priests, and I'm sure there are bishops living with AIDS. And even this very, very, very close experience, there is more sympathy for the priest who is a child abuser than there is for the priest with AIDS.
Well, that's for sure. You can see what just happened with the Vatican, overriding the American bishop's rather timid approach to this outrageous problem in the name of more compassion for fallen priests. It's bizarre. I thank you very much for joining
us
and filling us in on some of these barriers to solving this global catastrophe.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Frances Kissling, who's the president of Catholics for a Free Choice. Let's now go change the subject from World AIDS Day, which it is today, to the story that's been haunting us for the last week or so about U.S.-Saudi Arabian relations, and in particular the notion that members of the Saudi royal family have been, the allegation that they've been funneling aid to the 9/11 terrorists. I'm speaking with Stephen Schwartz, the author of a new book, Two Faces of Islam, House of Saud, From Tradition to Terror. And clearly the House of Saud is coming under a lot of pressure nowadays, not the least of which is the revelation that the wife of Prince Bandar, the ambassador to the United States, Princess Haifa al-Faisal, money that went to an intermediary, I think maybe even two intermediaries, ended up in the hands of two of the hijackers of 9/11 who crashed the plane into the Pentagon. Is there anybody leaking this stuff, do you think? Or, I mean, is there a campaign against the House of Saud going on here?
Oh, no, I think if anything, let's put it this way. Sorry to be so fumbling here. There is a campaign by anti-Saudi Muslims. There is a campaign, if you can call it a campaign, by a small group of people like myself to expose the nature of the Saudi state. As far as what's going on in Washington, there's a much more significant and widespread campaign in the other direction to defend the Saudi state. I know that some of the Saudi apologists, and some of what I would call, unfortunately, professional Arab apologists, meaning people who are paid to spout propaganda, and some of the neo-Nazis have been spouting the line that criticism of Saudi Arabia is connected with the campaign against Iraq in some iniquitous way, that this is a big Jewish plot to change the Middle East. By and large, the hawks on Iraq and Washington are soft on Saudi Arabia because they believe that Saudi Arabia is necessary for the completion of a campaign against Iraq. Furthermore, there's simply tremendous resistance in the media and in government to really examining the relationship with Saudi Arabia. When you look at it, there's a lot of talk in what I would call the mainstream media, in the sense of media outside Washington and New York. There's a lot of talk about Saudi Arabia that's pretty critical and flows in whatever direction it's going to go. But here in Washington, there's really a consistent campaign to say there is not a problem, or if there is a problem, the Saudis will fix it, or there are whole areas people just don't want to go. Powell, Secretary of State Colin Powell, is in the forefront of basically telling the American people that Saudi is not a problem. President Bush has made repeated statements guaranteeing the support of the Saudi regime for the war on terror. So if anything, there's a campaign in the opposite direction. Now, it is true that the Weekly Standard, which is considered a neocon organ, and which is quite strong on the Iraq issue, has also given me a platform to examine the Saudi situation. This doesn't mean that there's any kind of ideological conspiracy going on here, because both the editors of the Weekly Standard and myself are really under considerable pressure from the mainline conservatives and even elements in the Jewish and Israeli lobbies. You know, the Jewish and Israeli lobbies are much more concerned with, and I would say even obsessed with, Iran than with Saudi. And I've told a lot of people that a lot of this is about the fact that Saudi is a moderate state in Arab issues, or has posed as one, has presented itself as a moderate state on Arab issues, in that they want the Arabs to trust the United States to somehow work things out with Israel. But they're not a moderate state on Islamic issues. On Islamic issues, they're an extremely radical and extreme state. But one of the most amazing paradoxes of all this is that it's really quite common in the Jewish lobby and in the Israeli lobby to hear people say, people ask me, why are you so rough on the Saudis? Aren't they moderate? Isn't Iran the problem? I don't happen to think Iran is the problem. I think the time has come for the West to have an opening and a dialogue to Iran.
Well, clearly there's a revolution going on there.
That's right, and a very positive one. In fact, I would characterize it, it is a revolution, but it's a peaceful democratic transition so far, and I think that everything happening in Iran is extraordinarily positive, and I think the West has to stop referring to the leadership of Iran as the mad mullahs. To me, as far as I'm concerned, mullah is a hate term, because a mullah is a judge, a regional judge. Constant reference to the mullahs, the government of the mullahs, the mad mullahs, this is just meaningless verbiage. It's time for the West to open up to not just the reformers, but to the whole country of Iran and to the government of Iran, and to indicate that we in the West are very interested in and supportive of the evolution of the Islamic Republic away from its original, more rigid form.
Well, clearly the revolution is taking place in Iran, and it's led by the young and by women who are vastly outnumber the supporters for the Ayatollahs who control the organs of power. But however, let's just go back to Saudi Arabia and the influence and control of the Wahhabi sect and its enormous influence over Islam in the world. And it's worth noting that within Saudi Arabia itself, the Wahhabis don't necessarily, they dominate, but they don't necessarily, there's a large area of the country, the Shia on the Gulf side, and in the traditional, the holy places of Mecca and Medina, they're not necessarily supported.
No, they don't have the loyalty of the people. We don't think that more than 40% of the whole population of Saudi Arabia would define themselves as Wahhabis. And they definitely do not have, especially in the holy sites, as you say, you're right on the money. The holy sites have a tradition of Islamic pluralism and also a tradition of constitutional independence. And the Shias, who in my view are really, on social issues, the most progressive element in the whole country, the oil workers of the Eastern Province in particular, of course, both of these groups are ferociously oppressed by the Wahhabis.
And the whole country is terrorized. I mean, even the royal families, can't the religious police just come into any home at any time? And if the women are in the same rooms as the men or whatever,
yeah, but this doesn't affect the royal family. That would be like if thinking that the Gestapo would go in and question some Jewish German officer as to whether he knew any Jews or as to whether the gay PayU under Stalin would go and search Stalin's apartment for Trotskyist materials. No. Mm-hmm. Nobody in the royal family is subject to the harassment of the Mutawiyya. They are strictly a control device used against the masses and against the masses. They don't interfere with the royal family. The royal family does whatever it wants behind its the walls of its compounds.
So that indicates then the compact between the royals and the religious.
Yes, it's an alliance. Right. It's an alliance between the Saudis, who secure power by cultivating the Christian powers, and the Wahhabis, who secure control by their extremist ideology. And the two of them over the last 20 years, in response to the challenge of Khomeini, basically embarked in a program of ideological expansionism. Westerners never really understood that the Taliban really represented an experiment in the exportation of Wahhabism to see if it could be done to run another state as, in essence, on the model of Saudi governance.
So that was their imperial jewel, if you will. In terms of the influence it has over Islam and the negative influence and the need for an Islamic reformation to get away from the Wahhabis, obviously one of the main impediments, at least it seems, is that as long as you have this Israeli-Palestinian situation, you're always going to have this polarization. I mean, what?
Well, I'm not sure. Look, I think, you know, Israel, I keep telling people, I think that this Palestinian thing, of course, it affects Muslims because the situation of the holy site in Jerusalem affects Muslims. But in the end, it doesn't affect very much the actual daily lives of Moroccan, Balkan, Indian, Malaysian, Indonesian Muslims. And I think that part of the transition, and I don't use the term reformation, I prefer to almost talk about a counter-reformation or a restoration of Islamic pluralism. Part of it will be the need to basically do with the Jews what certain Jewish intellectuals are doing with the Muslims now. Certain Jewish intellectuals are saying, you can't brand all Muslims terrorists, you have to make distinctions. And I think that there will be a movement among Muslim believers who find solidarity with sincere Jewish believers, the Jewish peace camp, and leaders of the Jewish population in Israel that don't want the confrontation to continue. In essence, I'm saying that it's possible for the sincere Muslims and the sincere Jews in the Middle East to bypass Sharon and to bypass the Arab extremists. I know that must sound wildly utopian, but I don't see the obstacle to the restoration of pluralism in Islam being the Arab-Israeli conflict or anything having to do with the West so much as the West and Big Oil's compact with the Saudis, which has given these people enormous resources, plus their control of the holy sites. That's what gives them the basis to attempt to take over world Islam.
Well, just in closing then, Stephen Swartz, what can be done because back in 1923, before the Wahhabis took over, there was tremendous pluralism.
There really was. Yes, there was total pluralism in Mecca. What can be done? The only thing can be done, in my view, is that sincere people of goodwill, by which I mean sincere religious believers, sincere believers in peace, sincere believers in the future of humanity, so to speak, have to make it clear that Islam is an issue that they want to know more about, and they have to study and reach out and find the traditional Muslim believers. I would say, frankly, and people have heard this from me many times before, the best place to start is Sarajevo. The Muslims in Sarajevo went through this terrible nightmare, and yet they have a peace movement. They have a thriving peace movement. They reject Wahhabism, and they rejected terrorism. And to start dialoguing with people like the Muslim leaders of Bosnia, who can represent the possibility of a Muslim restoration of pluralism and a Muslim peace movement. I'll tell you something that sort of summarizes all this. I've read interesting polls about who the Muslim world considers its leaders. Izetbegovic, the former president of Bosnia, is considered much more a moral leader of the world's Muslims than anybody from Saudi. President Khatami in Iran has much more credibility as a leader of the world Muslims than Osama bin Laden. And men like this, men like Izetbegovic, who advocates for peace and reconciliation, and men like Khatami, who on a very fairly stringent basis, but is calling for a dialogue of the civilizations, these are the people that the Muslim world really looks to for leadership. When they're not diverted by the media issues having to do with the tragedy in the Middle East. And so I think that the West has to start dealing with these leaders and supporting them and talking to them and dialoguing with them. But it has to be a dialogue. I mean, I'm a supporter of democratization in the Middle East, but democratization in the Middle East doesn't mean trying to turn the Middle East into Disneyland. It means a dialogue in which Islamic societies will retain their Islamic character while attaining prosperity and stability.
And pluralism and democracy.
Well, that's what I mean. Islamic society means a pluralistic society. They will have the character that Turkey has, they will have the character that Malaysia has, they will have the character that Bosnia has, of societies that interpret Islam in terms of mercy, compassion, and respect for the other faiths, and pluralism within the faith, and very progressive conceptions of the status of women and the rights of the trade unions and so on and so forth.
Stephen Swartz, I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Stephen Swartz, who's the author of a new book, The Two Faces of Islam, The House of Saud, From Tradition to Terror. I'm now speaking with Ambassador James Aiken, former United States Ambassador to Saudi Arabia. And Ambassador Aikens, do you believe do you accept this premise that there's a need for some reformation and democratization in Islam and to reduce the influence of the Wahhabi sect if indeed they do dominate Islam?
Saudi Arabia.
Hello?
But I do think that there is a need to move toward democracy and toward pluralism in Islam. With that, I agree with Mr. Schwartz completely.
But how
the question of Wahhabi dominance of Saudi Arabia is something that I think is greatly exaggerated. They've had their ups and downs in Saudi Arabia. If you recall, in the early 20s, Abdulaziz had problems with them, and he slaughtered them all. And there were no more problems with the Wahhabi leaders under Abdulaziz. When he died and Saud took over, it started coming back, and Saud was weak and totally corrupt and surrounded by courtiers who bled the country dry, and they were very unpopular in the country, and the Wahhabis then came forth and criticized them, and Saud made a pact with them: don't criticize me and you can do what you want in the country. And they did, and they exercised great power under King Saud. When he was replaced by Faisal, they had no control over Faisal. And this is when I lived in Saudi Arabia, and the Wahhabis were not a problem, and the Mutawwin did not really exist. Social progress was made, tremendous social progress was made under King Faisal. Then he was killed, and Khalid took over and was sort of a neutral personality and didn't do very much. Then he died, and Fahad took over, and it was, in a sense, a replay of what had happened under Saud. The takeover of the mosque and of the Grand Mosque in Mecca in November 78 was an extraordinary blow to everyone in the country, that these people should attack the holiest site in Islam. They're very stupid, I might say.
This was the Iranian...
Over the holiest site in Islam, they turned everyone against them, and not only in Saudi Arabia, but in all of Dar al-Islam.
This was in a group of Iranians, wasn't it?
No, absolutely not.
Which
this is reported in the American press as an Iranian coup. I really had to laugh at this. See,
uh-huh.
It had absolutely nothing to do with Islam. These are Sunni fundamentalists, and they would not even consider the Shia as Muslims.
So these were ultra Wahhabis then.
Oh yes, well they were certainly whether they were Wahhabis or not, it's hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
This is a term that's used a little bit too broadly, I think. But they were certainly conservative and certainly against the Al-Saud, the House of Saud. And they broadcast their call to the Muslim world from the speakers of the mosque, which is stupid. They should have taken over Radio Mecca. Mm-hmm. And if they had broadcast from Radio Mecca, which is one of the most powerful stations in the world, they would have, who knows what the result would have been in the country. They criticized... They broadcast specific accusations against members of the family, against the king and members of the family, but they got nowhere because nobody heard them. They were just broadcasting to the precincts of the mosque. The rebellion was put down, the people were captured, and they were all executed. They'd commit an act of unbelievable impiety. You don't kill a chicken inside Mecca.
Mm-hmm.
But here they were killing human beings inside Mecca. And they turned the entire world against them, and they were executed. They think that the approval of almost every Muslim. But then Fahad was frightened, and then Fahad in turn did exactly what Saud had done and gave power to the Mutawwin, and they started coming back. But
weren't the people that caused the insurrection in effect spiritual allies of the Mutawwin?
Yes, they were. You said they were Iranians. They were not.
No, I know that much. Yeah, we got that straight.
Yes.
But I'm saying I can't understand the logic.
Oh, yes, they were. They were conservatives, and these were part of them. The Mutawwin were drawn from the same group,
mm-hmm.
And then the Mutawwin were given, were given authority, basically to do what they wanted in the country as a whole, go into people's houses, for example. Going to Christian houses if they saw a Christmas tree. It's great for Christian morale in the country at the time. That's past, though, now. That doesn't happen anymore. The breaking into the houses is something that stopped some time ago after Abdullah. Abdullah, of course, is not king, which is the problem. And, then, of course, he's not even crown prince. There is no crown prince in Saudi Arabia.
Mm.
He's the heir apparent, but he has...
But where does he stand on this pendulum swing that you've described?
Well, he's...
I've talked
to people about it, and I've asked a lot of Saudis about that, what will happen if he becomes king, and they say, well, he's finished, they're finished. And I said, are we speaking of disease, that is the extermination of them by force? He said, no, it won't be that, it'll be Faisal. They'll become irrelevant, they'll have no control over him, and their power will recede. One must not forget, however, that we are responsible for the Saudi venture into Afghanistan. It wasn't that they decided they were going to set up a Wahhabi government in Iran. We financed them. We urged the Saudis to send people there to fight godless communism. We wanted to turn Afghanistan into the Russian Vietnam. We were going to get even with what the Russians did to us in Vietnam. And it was a great victory for us, we thought, at the time. It, of course, backfired.
Mm-hmm.
But
aren't there deeper roots, though, going back to the Dulles brothers, the idea of fighting secular communism with religious fundamentalism?
Oh, yes, that's right. In fact, a lot of people in the Mideast believe that we had trouble with the Shah. And, you know, people are great in their deductive reasoning, but we had trouble with the Shah. The Shah had gone to Moscow a number of times, and we decided that we would get rid of him. I have some mullahs in charge who would be... obviously, very, very anti-communist, and these are the people that we would like. The revolution a little bit sour for us, of course, but there are still people who believe that we are responsible for the overthrow of the Shah.
Well, there's certainly the Russian leader, Putin, believes that the United States, and so did Yeltsin before him, that they, in stirring up, in fighting communism, they've opened the Pandora's box of Islamic fundamentalism.
Well, yes, they might have. Yes, they certainly have, to a certain extent.
Mm. Well, let's, just in the last couple of minutes, Ambassador James Akins, turn to this apparent campaign to drive a wedge between the United States and Saudi Arabia. What do you make of it? I mean, I take it that it's people like the Richard Pearl and the Team B and the neoconservative, the Wolfowitzes of the world that are behind unconditional support for Sharon and really beating a drum to go to war against Iraq. Are they also trying to drive this wedge?
Yeah, it's obvious. I mean, they make no bones of it, and it's quite ominous. I talk to some of these people and ask them what do they have in mind. Nobody can say that the Al Saud are perfect or that they are models of probity or good governance. But if there's a revolution in Saudi Arabia, it's not going to be a Jeffersonian Democrat who takes over. It's going to be someone like Bin Laden or Bin Laden clone. And if you had a free election in Saudi Arabia today, I don't think the Wahhabis, by the way, would win. But I don't think the Al Saud would win either. But if there's a revolution in the country, it's going to be conducted by the most violent elements of the society. And it would be an absolute catastrophe for us if Bin Laden were sitting in Riyadh. That's, of course, his main goal. Bin Laden's hatred for the United States, which must always remember, is primarily because we have supported the Al Saud.
Mm. That's his focus is Saudi Arabia. His target is America, but his focus is clearly Saudi Arabia.
That's
but
the goal. The goal is Saudi Arabia. He doesn't call it not Saudi Arabia, of course. It's the Republic of the Islamic of the Republic of the Arabian Peninsula.
The next caliphate.
Well, I think his aspirations to be caliph are rather overblown. I don't think he has that much appeal in even in Arabia, mm-hmm. and almost none outside of Arabia.
Well, just in the last minute then, Ambassador James Akins, what about the notion of some kind of reformation in Saudi Arabia that would affect the world Islam, obviously because of the control of the shrines? Is there any way to reduce, you said it ebbs and flows, the influence of the Wahhabis. Is there any practical or external way that it can be done? Or?
No, I think it's going to happen anyway. I think it's necessary and it's inevitable. As Mr. Schwartz said, Islam is a great tradition of tolerance and pluralism, and an awful lot of Muslims in the entire Middle East, in Egypt and in Syria and even in Saudi Arabia, who are yearning for a return to those old days. This narrow Wahhabism doesn't speak to the needs of most Muslims.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Ambassador James Akins.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with Ambassador James Akins, who was the United States Ambassador to Saudi Arabia. And you can get in touch with me at ianmasters@mail.com. Bye.